One of the great aims of your life must be the development of character. And the foundation quality of character is the virtue of integrity. On the wall of my first karate dojo, there was a sign which read, "The ultimate aim of karate lies not in victory or defeat, but in the perfection of the character of its participants." I thought about that for many years, and then I finally realized that it could be a paraphrase for the purpose of the human experience. We could say that the ultimate aim of individual experience lies not in achieving wealth or poverty, but in the development of the character of its participants. Our purpose must not be just to make a living, but to make a life, and a great life at that. Each of us needs to set living greatly as our highest goal. We need to set the highest standards for ourselves and then dedicate our lives toward achieving those standards. And integrity is the core quality of human greatness. When we say that a person has character, we mean that he or she will always act with integrity, no matter what the temptation or the external circumstance. Strength of character is the ability to choose integrity under all conditions. Even when we talk about the importance of courage, we are referring to the ability to do what is right as we see it, irrespective of the situation in which we find ourselves. E.M. Forster was once asked why he wrote so prolifically. He replied, "I write to earn the respect of those I respect." In my experience, most of what we do in life is done to earn the respect of the people we respect. And it is only when we are respected by others that we truly experience self-respect. It's very hard to like and respect yourself if the people you like and respect don't like and respect you in turn. But it's very easy to think well of yourself when the people around you think you're a good person. We know that self-esteem, how much you like yourself, is the hallmark of the healthy, happy personality. We also know that self-esteem can be defined as your reputation with yourself. And your reputation with yourself is determined by how much you respect yourself, which is a function of how much you are respected by others. Therefore, the quality of integrity as a fundamental part of your character and personality is a purely selfish act. When you live and act from the standpoint of integrity, you feel good about yourself, you feel comfortable in your relationships with others, and you sleep well at night. Over the years, I've served as a consultant to over 300 corporations. In this role, I've conducted strategic planning sessions for the key executives of several organizations, both large and small. The purpose of strategic planning is almost always the same: to increase return on equity by reorganizing and reallocating the resources of the company to achieve higher levels of productivity, performance, and profitability. A good strategic plan enables a corporation to concentrate its strengths on its areas of greatest potential and opportunity. The same process that is used for corporate strategic planning can also be used for personal strategic planning with the same results. The starting point of a strategic plan is to define values. What does this company stand for? What do we believe in as unchanging principles? What are the things we will do or not do in pursuit of the goals of this corporation? In personal planning, the same exercise is necessary. The starting point of all effective planning and goal setting is agreement on your basic values. Your basic values then become the foundation upon which you build your goals for your strategic objectives for each area of your life or business activities. Once you've selected your basic values, usually around 5 or 6 as we discussed earlier, you then organize your values in order of importance from the most important to the least important. Each higher order value will then take precedence over any lower order value. For example, if your 3 basic values in order were integrity, quality, and profitability, then you would sacrifice quality and profitability to integrity, and you would sacrifice profitability to integrity and quality. So not only are the values important, but the order of values is critical in determining the mission statement and philosophy of the company. We discussed this subject earlier in the session on strategic thinking. Precisely the same principles apply to you as an individual. The purpose of personal strategic planning is to enable you to increase your return on energy. It's to enable you to organize your life in such a way that you achieve the greatest amount of happiness and success, as you define it, from the deployment of your personal, mental, and physical resources. Interestingly enough, Every company for which I've done strategic planning in the last 15 years has chosen integrity as its number one most important value. Small or large, it seems that successful companies are successful because they have their values clear. Many of my clients' basic values were unclear or unarticulated, but the senior executives of each company were unanimous in selecting integrity as the basic operating principle to govern both their internal relationships with their staff and their external relationships with their customers, suppliers, bankers, and others. One executive pointed out to me recently that integrity is the value that guarantees all the other values that you select. The selection of integrity as your number one guiding principle assures that you will keep your word when it comes to living and acting consistently with the other values that you've selected. Your choice of the values that you will live by is one of the most important things that you will ever do. A value, once chosen, is carved in stone. You cannot practice a value only when it's convenient. When you choose and commit yourself to a value, you are making a firm decision to live by that value without compromise, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the temptations. A company whose executives chose integrity as their foremost guiding principle would prefer to see the company go out of business rather than to do something dishonest. An individual who chooses integrity as his or her primary value, if sincere, will not deviate from what is right, no matter what the cost. It's no surprise that virtually all successful people are known and respected for their integrity. The basis of all long-term relationships in our society is trust. It is knowing that you can rely on the other person to fulfill his or her commitments once they give their word. Someone once said that if honesty did not exist, it would have to be invented as the surest means for getting rich. All successful businesses in America are based on the honesty and integrity of the people involved. H.L. Hunt, the self-made oil billionaire, was so respected for his integrity that it was said that you could take a handshake from H.L. Hunt to the bank. Without a contract or a signature, Texas bankers would lend money to a man to whom H.L. Hunt had made a verbal commitment and sealed with a handshake. Most people, if asked, will profess to having high values. So how can you tell what another's values really are? More importantly, how can you tell what your values really are? The answer lies in observing the actions, not the words. All values are ultimately expressed in actions. If it is not expressed in actual behavior, it is not a value. It's merely a good intention. You can only tell what people really believe to be right and true by watching what they do, not what they say. You can only tell what your real values are by observing your own actions. Many people make the mistake of thinking that if they say it or write it or wish it or hope it or argue it with others, it's the same as having it as a value. But no, only actions demonstrate a person's values. It's only what you do, and especially what you do when the chips are down, that indicates to yourself and others what you really, truly believe and live by as a value. We always knew there was something wrong when our teachers or friends told us, "Do as I say, not as I do." And we always somehow knew when the action contradicted the words. That's why Emerson wrote, "What you are thunders at me so loudly that I cannot hear a word you are saying." Take the case of the mother who tells her child over and over, "Never tell lies, always tell the truth, no matter what it costs." Then, when Aunt Martha, who talks too much, calls on the telephone and the child answers, the mother says, "Tell her I'm not home." What does the child learn about honesty and integrity from this experience? Well, the child learns that honesty and telling the truth can be depended upon and corrupted by something called situational ethics. The child learns that integrity is not an absolute value, but rather that it is a value that is to be practiced when it's convenient and comfortable. One of the great problems that we face in our society today is this tendency toward situational ethics. Men and women in positions of responsibility cut corners and compromise their integrity when money or power is at issue. Unfortunately, it's been well said that a people get the kind of government they deserve. The people in power can be no better than the people who put them there. If we desire to improve the overall character of our political and economic systems, we must first begin by going to work on the moral character of ourselves as individuals in our day-to-day lives. This means, first of all, setting integrity as an absolute and immutable standard for our own behavior, and then, second, refusing to compromise our integrity, no matter what the price we have to pay. When we do this, not only will we feel stronger and prouder, but we will also feel ourselves to be more capable and effective in all our interactions with others. If we agree that integrity is the core quality of character, and we're committed to living lives of integrity, perhaps the next thing we should do is to define exactly the meaning of integrity. Webster's Ninth New Collegiate Dictionary defines integrity as an unimpaired condition, soundness, firm adherence to a code of moral values, incorruptibility, the quality or state of being complete or undivided, completeness, honesty, and we could add, perfect, without fault or flaw, completely together. Of course, having integrity also means that we should never lie, cheat, steal, break the Ten Commandments, or do anything else that is wrong or illegal. Most people, probably 95%, are pretty honest and go through their lives without getting much more than a traffic ticket. But integrity means more than this. Practicing integrity means living in truth with yourself and others. Shakespeare said it best in Hamlet, "To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man." Integrity then means being true to yourself, being true to the very best that is in you. It means looking at every situation and asking, what is right? What is fair? What is the correct thing to do under all circumstances? Some years ago, I worked with a brilliant businessman who had started with very little and had amassed a personal fortune of more than $500 million. He had business interests in banking, insurance, trust companies, automobile dealerships, restaurants, apartments, office buildings, agriculture, and printing. He had an amazing ability to spot an opportunity and then to bring together the people and the financial resources to turn the opportunity into a profitable business. A major part of his success was that he had an incredible reputation for being a man of impeccable integrity. I worked with him for 3 years and handled many projects for him worth many millions of dollars, and I learned a lot by watching and listening. One day we found ourselves in a situation where a business deal did not work out as expected. We were the major shareholder, and according to the contract, the smaller shareholder owed the company a lot of money. When I brought the contract to this businessman, I was very adamant that we were clearly in the right and that the other shareholder didn't have a leg to stand on. I'll never forget what he told me. He said, "Brian, it's not only necessary to be right, but to appear to be right. Putting the contract aside, what is the fair thing to do in this situation?" He then went on to insist that we accept our loss and let the other party off the hook. He pointed out that it was a small matter for a company of our size, but a huge matter for the smaller business. He said that even though we were clearly in the right legally, it could be interpreted as a big company taking advantage of a small company. He felt that it was better to let it go, to give up our right to compensation in order to protect our company's reputation as an impeccably honest and fair place to do business with. I learned later that the most valuable asset that you will ever have is how you are known to others, your reputation for honesty and fair dealing. Shakespeare also said, "He who steals my purse steals trash, but he who steals my good name steals all." You must never allow anyone or anything to cast aspersions on your character. You must guard your good name and your reputation for integrity above all things. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Cash is money and credit is money, and the man with a reputation for prompt repayment of his debts can always have all the money his friends have available." A friend of mine went bankrupt some years ago as a result of signing a personal guarantee for an investment in which several others were involved. He'd worked for many years and had developed a reputation for always doing what he said he would do. But the bankruptcy court took everything he owned, leaving him almost penniless and in the position of having to start all over again at the age of 50. The day before he was discharged in bankruptcy, he received a phone call from a man he'd done business with in the past. The man said, "I understand that you will be out of bankruptcy tomorrow. The minute you're ready to start again, I'll transfer $100,000 to your bank account. I have complete confidence in you, and I know you'll make it all back. And that was just the beginning. Literally the day after he walked out of the bankruptcy court, he began receiving offers for large sums of money that he could use to begin investing and developing again. His reputation for honesty and integrity enabled him to start over immediately, and the result is that he has since built a $1 million business and is well on his way to making his second fortune. The highest form of integrity is to maintain your reputation with yourself, to be true to yourself, to be true to the highest and best that is in you. Integrity means to live in truth, and the highest expression of integrity is to set peace of mind as your highest goal. When you set your own peace of mind as your highest goal, you are making a decision to systematically go through each area of your life and deal with, remove, or eliminate any situation that is not in keeping with inner peace. Integrity means facing life as it is, not as you wish it could be. Integrity means having the courage to admit that you may have made a mistake and that you may have gotten yourself into circumstances that are making you unhappy. Setting peace of mind as your highest goal, as your organizing principle for all your other goals and activities, means being willing to cut your losses. One of Murphy's laws, remember, is before you do anything, you have to do something else first. One of the realities of life is that before you can start something new in any area of your life, you often have to stop or discontinue doing something old. Before you can commit yourself to new goals, new careers, new relationships, new opportunities, you often have to leave behind the old situations that no longer enhance your life or serve your purposes. If peace of mind and the happiness and joy that go with it are your highest goals, you will find that living with absolute integrity, especially in your interactions with others, becomes indispensable. Integrity means listening to your intuition, trusting the still, small voice within, and going with the flow of your own nature. It means doing what you know is right for you, even if it contradicts decisions and choices that you've made in the past. To quote Emerson again, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. What he was referring to is the tendency for people to always remain consistent with what they had done and said in the past. This is one of the most common and frustrating tendencies of the average person. Rather than to say, I changed my mind, or I was wrong, I made a mistake, the average person goes through a complex exercise of justification and rationalization to try to remain consistent with something that's often completely contrary to what makes him or her happy. The person of integrity, on the other hand, stands back and objectively examines each part of his or her life regularly. He or she will ask, do I feel good about this? Does this situation make me happy? Do I feel enriched and fulfilled as a result of staying in this situation? Is what I'm doing consistent with my highest and best good? Am I being true to myself? Am I fulfilling my potential and becoming everything I'm capable of becoming? The real test of a value such as integrity is when it costs you money, emotion, or time to live up to it. It's only when you have to make hard choices and take specific actions that you demonstrate whether or not the value is a real one for you. It's only when you have to pay or make sacrifices that you know whether it's a value or not. Integrity in yourself means quality in everything you do. Integrity is the inner attitude of mind. Quality work is the outward expression. You make a statement about yourself with everything you do or fail to do. If one definition of integrity is seamless, it means that your inner and outer lives are completely aligned, completely congruent. It means that you always do the very best job you can under all circumstances. The natural tendency of human beings is to take the path of least resistance, to do what is fun and easy and convenient, rather than what is right and hard and necessary. The path of least resistance leads people to avoid conflict, confrontation, difficulty, or discomfort. Many people would rather be unhappy than to deal honestly with their lives. This is especially true in relationships. Often people convince themselves that even though they're unhappy, they're somehow obligated to stay in a relationship in order to ensure the happiness of someone else. They think that by being miserable and unfulfilled, they are somehow doing something good and beneficial for someone else. They sacrifice their own peace of mind for someone or something else. After I had spoken about this subject in one of my seminars, a young woman about 28 came up to me, somewhat agitated. She explained to me that she'd been in a relationship for 4 years with a man who was negative and critical and continually finding fault with everything she did. They were engaged to be married. She'd been going out with this man longer than she'd ever gone out with anyone else. She asked me if I was recommending that she give up her 4-year investment in the relationship and just start over for the sake of peace of mind. To help her put her situation in perspective, I asked her how long she intended to live. She was surprised at the question and asked me what I meant. I told her that the average 28-year-old female today could expect to live to be about 81 years old because of the way modern medicine and science was increasing the average lifespan. I then asked her the key question. How many years do you have left if you're going to live to the age of 81? She thought for a minute and then she suddenly understood. She realized that it was not the number of years she had invested in the past that was important, but the number of years she had ahead of her. The expression on her face changed from one of confusion to one of clarity and determination. She thanked me and went away. I saw her again about 3 weeks later. Her face was shining and radiant, and she looked completely happy. Before she even opened her mouth, I said, "You decided to dump him, didn't you?" She said, "I sure did, and it was the smartest thing I've ever done." There seems to be something in the universe that says you must never compromise your integrity or peace of mind for anything. Because if you do compromise your peace of mind for something, a relationship, money, career, fame, or something else, you'll end up with neither. If you compromise your integrity and your peace of mind for a relationship, you'll end up with neither your peace of mind nor your relationship. If you compromise your peace of mind for a job or money, you'll end up with neither the job nor the money. It's almost as though there were a force in the universe that rewards us when we live our lives consistent with our highest good, our integrity, and our peace of mind, and punishes us the minute we deviate from or compromise on what we know to be right. When we live with integrity, we bring ourselves into harmony with the great laws of the universe. It's also true that living with integrity is a habit. And even if a person has had a tendency to cut corners in the past, it's possible to develop the habit of perfect honesty by practicing integrity in every situation without exception until the quality becomes completely embedded in your character. There are several ways you can practice developing and reinforcing the habit of integrity. We've touched on some of them earlier in this course. The starting point of developing unshakable integrity is by applying the law of concentration, which says that whatever you dwell upon grows. Whenever you think about men or women of high integrity, or read about them, or watch stories about them on television or in movies, you tend to absorb and internalize those qualities that you most admire. In one study, the majority of men and women who became leaders later in life were found to have been avid readers of biographies and autobiographies of other leaders in their formative years. Whenever you read a story or biography, you tend to personally identify with the main character. If you read stories about men and women who have triumphed over adversity or who have risen to high places in life by virtue of their qualities of courage and integrity, you unconsciously absorb those qualities into your own character. The role models you choose determine the person you become. In the best-selling book, In His Shoes, all the residents of a city agreed to govern their behavior by asking the question, "What would Jesus do?" By selecting Jesus as their role model and guide for behavior, the entire character of the town changed. After an initial period of disruption, the residents experienced greater happiness, harmony, and prosperity. Their every action was guided by the highest moral principles, including, and especially, the principle of integrity. Each person was, in effect, being forced to continually ask himself or herself, "Is what I am doing consistent with the very best that I know?" As people applied this principle to their everyday lives, disagreements and misunderstandings were resolved, lawsuits were settled, products and services produced by local businesses improved. People treated each other with a greater kindness and tolerance, and the entire population began living in truth with each other and with themselves. It was a remarkable story. In your relationships with others, there is a common principle that runs through all the world's great religions. The Indian mystic Shankara said, "Do not do to others what is hateful to yourself." Jesus of Nazareth stated this principle as the golden rule. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The discipline and the self-restraint necessary to practice this rule is a tremendous exercise in the development of your own character. Although it's hard to put into practice consistently, the benefits that you receive in the form of higher quality human relationships more than make up for your efforts. The philosopher Immanuel Kant suggested what he called the universal maxim as a guide for human behavior. He said, "Live your life as though your every act were to become a universal law. In everything you do, ask yourself what would happen if everyone else behaved the same way." Men and women of integrity, consciously and unconsciously, use this principle to guide their behaviors and all their decisions. An excellent exercise in the development of integrity is for you to ask, what kind of a world would this world be if everybody in it was just like me? If your answer to that is favorable, then you can go on to ask, what kind of a country would this country be if everyone in it were just like me? What kind of a country would America be if everyone in it behaved exactly the way I do? Then you can ask, what kind of a company would this company be if everybody in it were just like me? And finally, you could ask, what kind of a family would my family be if everyone in it were just like me? By holding yourself to a high standard, you become a better person. You become a role model for others. You set an example that others aspire to. No one is perfect. We all have a long way to go. The purpose in asking ourselves these questions is to help us see the areas in our lives where there's room for improvement. The harder the questions we ask ourselves, the higher the standards we set for ourselves, the faster we will develop the qualities of integrity and character that go hand in hand with personal greatness. Now, here are some thoughts that may be helpful to you as you work on the development of your character and your integrity. First, always live in truth. Never tell a lie. Refuse to live a lie. Refuse to participate in a lie, especially when a relationship is involved. Second, never do work that you don't believe in. Never sell or recommend a product or service that you do not believe in or that you would not use or recommend to your mother. Third, always decide what's right before you worry about what's possible. When you have a hard decision to make involving finances, remember that it's only money, and resolve to do whatever is right if there were no money involved. Fourth, integrity means never deluding yourself or expecting to violate a natural law. Never look for or expect to get more out than you have put in. Fifth, a person of character and integrity treats everyone the same. Thomas Carlyle once said, "You can tell a big man by the way he treats little men." Be kind, straightforward, and honest with every person you meet in every situation. Sixth, never expect riches without working or easy money or to get rich quick. More years and more dollars are wasted looking for a fast, easy way to make a lot of money than you can imagine. And people looking for easy riches will always find people willing to take their money away from them. There's an old saying that says, when a man with money meets a man with experience, the man with experience is going to end up with the money, and the man with the money is going to end up with the experience. Never look for or expect something for nothing. It takes many years of hard work and careful savings to achieve financial independence. Integrity means being willing to pay the full price of success in advance before expecting to receive it. And seventh, integrity means accepting complete responsibility for yourself and for every part of your life. A person of character looks to himself or herself as the cause of his or her life. Everything that happens to you is the result of your own thinking. your own conduct, and your own behavior. The development of integrity, being true to yourself and others, living up to the very best that is in you, and setting a standard for your behavior that everyone could follow and be better for living by, these are the giant steps toward the development of your full potential as a human being. Here's an exercise for you. Take a pad of paper and draw a line down the center from top to bottom. On the left-hand side, make a list of the areas in your life which cause you stress, rob you of peace of mind, or in which you feel you are not being true to the best that is in you. On the right-hand side of the line, make a list of the specific, concrete actions that you could engage in immediately, the things that you could start doing or stop doing that would bring this area of your life more into alignment with your innermost values and convictions. Resolve to go systematically through your life and take steps to change every situation that is not consistent with high integrity and greatness of character. Let your peace of mind be your barometer of what is right or wrong for you. Continue in this process until the peace that passes all understanding pervades every area of your life. Continue until you're living in truth in every part of your work and personal activities. You will find yourself feeling wonderful about everything you do when you practice integrity in every situation. The greatest challenge that you will ever face in life is the conquest of fear and the development of the habit of courage. Winston Churchill once wrote, "Courage is rightly considered the foremost of the virtues, for upon it all others depend." Fear is and always has been the greatest enemy of mankind. When Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," he was saying that the emotion of fear, rather than any reality, is what causes us anxiety, stress, and unhappiness. When you develop the habit of courage and unshakable self-confidence, a whole new world of possibilities opens up for you. Just think, what would you dare to dream or be or do if you weren't afraid of anything in the whole world? Fortunately, the habit of courage can be learned, just as the habits of fear have been learned. No one is born with fear, so every fear you experience as an adult had to be taught to you as you were growing up. Many of our fears and our propensities to be afraid originated in early childhood as a result of destructive criticism and physical or emotional punishment. These and other mistakes that our parents may have made cause us to develop the fears of failure and rejection early in life, and then, by repetition and reinforcement, carry them forward with us into adulthood. The opposite of fear is actually love. "There is no fear in love," the Bible says, "and perfect love casteth out fear." Love, of course, begins with self-love or self-esteem, and then expands gradually to a love for others, and then to a love for the very idea of life itself. Since your thoughts on the inside eventually become your realities on the outside, the practice of self-love, self-acceptance, and love for others eventually creates around you a world in which there is very little room for fear. This is the ideal toward the saints and mystics of all ages have struggled in order to show the rest of us the way to inner peace. But this level of consciousness comes later. At our stage of mental development, we need to go to work systematically to diminish and eradicate our fears, while simultaneously building up the kind of courage that will enable us to deal with the inevitable ups and downs of life unafraid. Syndicated columnist Ann Landers wrote these words, "If I were asked to give what I consider the single most useful bit of advice for all humanity, it would be this: expect trouble as an inevitable part of life, and when it comes, hold your head high. Look it squarely in the eye and say, 'I will be bigger than you. You cannot defeat me.' This is the kind of attitude that leads on to victory." The starting point in overcoming fear and developing courage is, first of all, to look at the factors that predispose us toward being afraid, and second of all, to analyze our own fears objectively. As we know, the root source of fear is childhood conditioning that causes us to experience the fear of failure, the feeling that I can't, I can't, I can't. That, and the fear of rejection, which causes us to feel that I have to, I have to, I have to. We become preoccupied with the idea of losing our money or our time or our emotional investment in a relationship. We become hypersensitive to the opinions and possible criticisms of others, sometimes to the point that we're afraid to do anything that anyone else might disapprove of. Our fears tend to paralyze us, holding us back from taking constructive action in the direction of our dreams and goals. We hesitate, we become indecisive, and we procrastinate. We make excuses and find reasons not to make progress and to move ahead. And finally, we feel frustrated, caught in the double bind of, I have to, but I can't, or I can't, but I have to. Fear is also caused by ignorance. When we don't know what to do or what's going on, when we have limited information, we tend to be tense and insecure about the outcome or result of our actions. Ignorance causes us to fear change, to fear the unknown, and to avoid trying anything new or different. Wonderfully enough, the very act of gathering more and more information about a particular subject causes us to have more courage and confidence in that area. There are parts of your life where you have no fear at all because you feel knowledgeable and completely capable of handling whatever happens in that area. Another factor that causes fear is illness or fatigue. Vince Lombardi once said, "Fatigue doth make cowards of us all." When we're tired or unwell, or when we're not physically fit, we're more predisposed to fear and doubt than when we're feeling healthy and happy and terrific about ourselves. One of the most destructive consequences of fear is that it causes us to sell ourselves short and to settle for far less out of life than we're capable of achieving. We tend to compare ourselves unfavorably with others and to conclude that while others may be capable of success and prosperity, somehow we are not good enough. We begin to invest more mental effort in making excuses than we do in finding ways to move toward our goals. The second step to overcoming fear is to sit down and take the time to objectively identify, define, and analyze your own personal fears. At the top of a clean sheet of paper, write the question, "What am I afraid of?" Now, before you begin, I need to make an important point. All intelligent people are afraid of something. It is normal and natural to be concerned about your physical, emotional, and financial survival. Aristotle said that all virtues, including the virtue of courage, live on the golden mean. He said that a virtue falls halfway between two vices, and the two vices on the opposite sides of courage are cowardice on the one side and impetuosity on the other. It is not a virtue to disregard your safety or the safety and well-being of others. When I was 15, I discovered the important fact that everyone is afraid. You and I and everyone you meet are afraid of something, and in most cases, many things. The courageous person is not a person who is unafraid. As Mark Twain said, courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. It's not whether or not you are afraid. We're all afraid. The question is, how do you deal with the fear? The courageous person is simply one who masters the fear and goes forward in spite of the fear. And here's something else I learned. When you confront your fears and face your fears and move toward what you are afraid of, your fears actually diminish and your self-esteem and self-confidence increase. However, when you allow your fears to dominate you and you move away from or avoid the thing you fear, your fears grow until they begin to control every aspect of your life. And as your fears increase, your self-esteem, your self-confidence, and your self-respect diminish accordingly. Begin filling out your list of fears by writing down everything, major and minor, that you experience any anxiety or worry over. The most common fears, of course, are the fear of failure, which is expressed in the fear of poverty or of being poor or broke or fired, and the fear of rejection. The fear of rejection expresses itself in the fear of criticism, the fear of ridicule, the fear of not being recognized or respected by people who are important to you. It's also quite common to fear the loss of love of someone you care about, your spouse, your parents, your friends, or even your children. Many people fear ill health and the problem. The law of emotion says that you are 100% emotional, and that whichever emotion dominates your mind will determine the decision that you make. The two major groups of emotions are those associated with fear and those associated with desire. High-performing men and women make most of their decisions based on their desires and their aspirations, whereas underachievers make most of their decisions based on their fears and worries. Whichever emotions are strongest in your thinking will determine what you do and what happens to you. So write out a list of every fear you think may be having an effect on your thinking and your behavior. Go over the list and organize it in order of importance. Which fear do you feel has the greatest impact on your thinking or holds you back more than any other? Which fear would be number two? What would be your third fear? And so on. With your predominant fear, write the answers to these three questions. First, how does this fear hold me back in life? What does it stop me from doing? Second, how does this fear help me? Or how has it helped me in the past? How have I benefited from this fear? What payoff have I received? Third, how would I benefit? What would be my payoffs for eliminating this fear? What would I do differently if this fear did not exist? Some years ago, I went through this exercise and I concluded that my biggest fear was the fear of poverty. I was afraid of not having enough money, of being broke, perhaps of even being destitute. I knew that this fear had come from my parents continually worrying about money during my childhood as a result of their experiences in the Depression growing up. It had been reinforced when I was broke at various times during my 20s. Even though I could objectively assess the origins of this fear, it still had a strong hold on me. Even when I had sufficient money for all my needs, this fear was always there. My answer to the question, how does this fear hold me back, was that it caused me to be fearful and anxious about taking risks with money. It caused me to play it safe with regard to employment, and it caused me to choose security over opportunity. My answer to the second question, how does this fear help me, was that in order to escape the fear of poverty, I had a tendency to work much longer and harder. I was more ambitious and determined. I took much more time to inform myself on the various ways that money could be invested. The fear of poverty was, in effect, driving me toward financial independence. When I answered the question, what would be my payoff for overcoming this fear, I immediately saw that I would be willing to take more risks. I would be more aggressive in pursuing my financial goals. I could and would start my own business, and I would not be so tense and concerned about spending too much or having too little. I would no longer be so concerned about the price of everything. By objectively analyzing my fears in this way, I was able to begin the process of eliminating them. As the result of practicing the methods and ideas taught in the earlier session on mental programming, I can quite comfortably say that I have almost totally eliminated my major fear, and my life is much happier as a result, as yours will be. You can begin the process of developing courage and eliminating fear by using what you have learned about mental programming, starting with the law of reversibility. Remember, the law of reversibility says that you can act your way into feeling just as you normally feel your way into acting. It says that if you engage in actions consistent with the behaviors of courage and self-confidence, then you will soon begin to feel unafraid and confident. The law of practice says that anything that you practice over and over eventually becomes a new habit. Well, here are some of the areas where you can practice to develop the habit of courage. The first and perhaps most important kind of courage is the courage to begin, to launch, to step out in faith. This is the courage to try something new or different, to move out of your comfort zone with no guarantee of success. John Ronstadt, a professor at Babson College who taught entrepreneurship for 12 years, conducted a study of those who left his class and became successful. he could only find one thing that they had in common, and it was their willingness to actually start their own businesses in the marketplace. He called this the corridor principle. He found that almost every one of them achieved their success in an area different from the area in which they started. He said that as they move forward, as though down a corridor, other doors open to them that they would not have seen if they had not been in forward motion in the first place. It turned out that the graduates of his entrepreneurship course who had done nothing with what they had learned were still waiting for things to be just right before they began. They were unwilling to launch themselves down the corridor of uncertainty until they could somehow be assured that they would be successful, something which never happened. The future belongs to the risk-takers, not the security-seekers. Life is perverse in the sense that the more you seek security, the less of it you have. But the more you seek opportunity, the more likely it is that you will achieve the security that you desire. One way to get the courage to begin, from which everything else flows, is to plan and prepare thoroughly in advance. Set clear goals and objectives, then gather information. Read and research in your chosen field. Write out detailed plans of action, and then take the first step. The second kind of courage is the courage to endure, to persist, to stay at it once you've begun. Persistence is a form of courageous patience, and it's one of the rarest forms of courage. Courageous patience is having the ability to stand firm after you've begun and before you get any feedback or results from your actions. Andrew Carnegie said, "A man who can master patience can master anything else." To plan your work and work your plan and persist patiently, even in the face of disappointment and unexpected short-term setbacks, is not only a form of courage, but it builds and develops the quality of courage within you. Another form of personal courage that superior men and women develop is the courage to see yourself and accept yourself as you really are, not as you wish you could be. The truly mature person is the person who has the courage to be perfectly honest with himself or herself. It's having the courage to admit that perhaps you're not as good as you would like to be, and perhaps even not as good as other people think you are. It's having the courage to give up your favorite excuses, your favorite justifications and rationalizations. It's having the courage to accept 100% responsibility for your life and for everything that happens to you, instead of blaming other people and situations outside yourself. Another important form of courage is the courage to make a total 100% commitment to yourself, to your job, to your family, and to your future. High-achieving men and women are always characterized by extraordinary levels of commitment to what they're doing. But in order to commit wholeheartedly, you have to be willing to burn your bridges behind you. You have to cut off your other options. You cannot be doing one thing or spending time in one situation while simultaneously thinking about being and doing something else somewhere else. Interestingly enough, the very act of committing yourself unequivocally to someone or something is extremely liberating and gives you a tremendous sense of confidence, competence, and well-being. Making a firm decision that you're going to do just this one thing and nothing else raises your self-esteem and improves your overall self-image. It gives you a surge of energy and enthusiasm that propels you forward toward high achievement. Another form of courage that requires tremendous ego strength is the courage to cut your losses, to be willing to admit that you've made a mistake, that your choice or decision was wrong and needs to be changed or corrected. This is a kind of courage that stubborn and inflexible people have a very hard time developing. I call the analysis that this kind of courage demands what I described earlier as zero-based thinking. It requires that you put every decision that you've made in the past on trial for its life on a regular basis. The three critical areas where zero-based thinking are most helpful are with regard to people, investments, and courses of action. The question that you ask with regard to people is, if I had not gotten into this relationship with this person, knowing what I now know, would I choose to get into this relationship now? In business, you ask, if I had not hired this person, knowing what I now know, would I hire him or her now? In an intimate relationship, you would ask, if I had not become involved with this person, knowing what I now know about him or her, would I choose to get involved if I had to do it over? The unwillingness or inability through lack of courage or lack of self-honesty to ask and answer these questions is a major source of stress and unhappiness in the lives of many people. Zero-based thinking should also be applied to investments. The question you ask is, if I had not made this investment, knowing what I now know, would I make it now? Perhaps the number one reason why people fail in their investment activities is because of their inability or unwillingness to admit that they have made a poor choice and to cut their losses. With regard to any other decision, continually ask yourself, if I had not made this decision, taken this job, spent this money, decided to do or not do this thing, knowing what I now know, would I make this decision now? It's amazing how much unhappiness is caused by not having the courage to go back and say that you've changed your mind, that you've made a mistake, that you are not happy with your previous decision, and that you want to change it. Perhaps the most important form of courage is the courage to dream big dreams, to set big, challenging goals for yourself, and to continue to hold a vision before you of the exciting life you want to live. Psychological studies have shown that the very act of setting a big goal raises your self-esteem, improves your self-image, and makes you feel better about yourself. You need a big purpose to which you can commit yourself in order to overcome the fear and inertia that holds most people back. If there is something big enough that you want badly enough, you will be able to develop the momentum to charge forward and through the self-doubt that stops most others. The conscious mind can only hold one thought at a time, positive or negative, a thought of fear or a thought of courage. Thoughts of courage build the habit of courage, while thoughts of fear reinforce the tendency to be afraid. As we discussed, the starting point of all change and improvement is desire. You must intensely desire to build the quality of fearlessness into your character. In addition, you must absolutely believe that it is possible for you to become the kind of bold, courageous person that you admire and want to be like. Then you begin the process of mental programming by thinking about yourself as you would ideally be. Begin creating a vision or image of yourself as calm, confident, and unafraid in your work and in your relationships. Write out a detailed description of the way you wish to feel, the way you want to be described by others, and the way you want to appear on the outside. Begin to visualize yourself as completely unafraid in the situations that normally induce fear reactions. See yourself performing in a relaxed and friendly manner, completely in control of yourself and your emotions. Recall and relive the times in your life when you've been at your very best, when you've felt absolutely terrific about yourself and what you were doing. Now, begin to use positive affirmations to drive the new programming into your subconscious mind. Repeat expressions like, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. This is the antidote or override affirmation for the fear of failure. Or you can repeat the affirmation, I feel completely calm, confident, and unafraid. I feel completely calm, confident, and unafraid. Or you can say, I am completely calm, confident, and unafraid. When you repeat these affirmations with enthusiasm and conviction, they're accepted by your subconscious mind as commands. Your subconscious mind will then begin to make your thoughts, feelings, and reactions fit a pattern consistent with your orders. Verbalize aloud to yourself and others. Look at yourself in the mirror and talk to yourself positively. Psych yourself up for an important event or sale or confrontation. If others ask you how you feel, tell them that you feel terrific, that you feel great, that you feel very confident about the outcome. The law of expression says that whatever is expressed is impressed. If you express your confidence to others, it is impressed into your own subconscious mind. Be sure to act the part of a completely unafraid individual. Walk and talk and smile with your shoulders back and your head held high as though you had not a care or fear in the world. Behave as if you are completely unafraid, and in a few minutes, you will begin to genuinely experience the emotion of fearlessness. Dr. Dorothea Brand, in her wonderful book, Wake Up and Live, explained her secret of success in the words, "Once you have decided what you want, act as if it were impossible to fail." If you act courageously, you will feel courageous. If you act confidently, you will feel confident. If you act as though it were impossible to fail, the very action will tend to generate the successful results that you desire. Begin forming a new reference group of courageous men and women with whom you can associate and identify. One of the best ways to do this is to read the biographies and autobiographies of men and women whose lives have been characterized by courage and daring. Read the biographies of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Florence Nightingale, Robert E. Lee, Alexander the Great, Napoleon Bonaparte, and Joan of Arc. Many successful men and women have deliberately molded their characters by studying and dwelling upon the lives and experiences of the great men and women of history. Consciously choose to associate and be around other men and women who seem to be positive and unafraid of life. Get away from the negative people, people who are always pointing out the reasons to be insecure and afraid. Control your suggestive environment carefully, and especially your human environment, if you wish to become the exceptional person you're capable of. Another major cause of the negative emotions that cause people to be afraid of too many things is what is called negative imagination. Negative imagination is another name for worry, and worry is a form of negative goal setting. Worry is a sustained form of fear caused by indecision. It is thinking about and talking about and vividly imagining exactly what you don't want to happen. If you worry long enough and hard enough about something, you're going to attract it into your life. In the book of Job, he says, "That which I greatly feared has come upon me." The great tragedy is that even if the situation you're worrying about does not materialize, your health and your emotions will suffer just exactly as if it did. The fact is that most of the things that people worry about never really happen, and 99% of the problems you have probably arise from things you had not thought to worry about in the first place. One of the most powerful techniques ever developed to conquer fear and eliminate worry is what one of my students called the Worry Buster. Many people have come back to me and said that this simple method has changed their lives and their attitudes from negative to positive and enabled them to become more effective in their work and their personal lives than they had ever thought possible. The Worry Buster consists of four simple steps. Step one is to define the problem or situation you are worrying about clearly in writing. The best way to do this is to take a pad of paper and draw a line from top to bottom right down the middle. On the left side of the pad of paper, write a clear description of your problem, an answer to the question, "What exactly am I worrying about?" Fully 50% of all problems can be solved in the definition stage. In medicine, they say that accurate diagnosis is half the cure. Many of our worries exist because we've not taken the time to sit down and really define clearly what it is that's bothering us. Step two is to write out the worst possible outcome of the worry situation. On the right-hand side of the page, answer the question, "What is the worst possible thing that can happen as a result of this problem?" Write out your answer in detail. You may lose your money. You may lose your relationship or your job or your investment or your health or the good opinion of someone else. Whatever it is, write it down. Steps 1 and 2 will alleviate most of the stress that causes worry. What we have found is that it is resistance to facing the worst possible outcome that causes most of the anxiety and stress associated with worry. Once you've written down the worst possible thing that can happen, you find that much of your worry evaporates. Step 3 is to resolve to accept the worst possible outcome should it occur. Once you've resolved to accept the worst should it occur, you no longer have anything to worry about. All the stress caused by denial, by refusing to face what the worst could be, suddenly evaporates. Step 4 is to begin immediately to to improve upon the worst. Having resolved to accept the worst should it occur, now think of everything you could possibly do to make sure that the very worst doesn't occur. Once you resolve to accept the worst, your mind will now be calm and clear and capable of creative thought. You'll be able to see all kinds of possibilities in the situation that were blurred before because of your worry. Now you're in a position to do something constructive. The only real antidote to worry is purposeful action toward a predetermined goal or solution. Once you've applied the worry buster to a problem, you're ready to get going and get busy. Since the conscious mind can only hold one thought at a time, when you get so busy doing something to resolve your problem, you'll not have the time or the mental capacity to worry. And before you look up or turn around, your worry situation will have been resolved. The mastery of fear and the development of courage are essential prerequisites for a happy, successful life. You can systematically train yourself to the point where if one day when someone asks you, "What have you always wanted to do but been afraid to attempt?" you'll be able to say, "Nothing." You'll eventually reach the point where your fears have diminished to such a degree that they no longer play a major role in your decision-making. You'll have the courage to set big, challenging, exciting goals, and you'll have the confidence of knowing that you can attain them. You'll be able to face every situation with calmness and self-assurance. You won't be afraid of anybody or anything. And as your fears die away and your courage grows, your potential becomes unlimited. Here's an exercise for you. Identify one specific area in your life where fear is getting in your way, and then challenge yourself to confront the fear, to do the thing you fear, and to get rid of the fear. Analyze it the way I explained in this session. How does it hold you back? How do you benefit from this fear? What difference would it make in your life if you could get rid of this fear once and for all? Then, challenge yourself to confront